This next presentation, which is titled The Logical Steps of a Watershed-Based Defense Burn Mitigation, is meant to address the second desired outcome, clarify the logical steps of a watershed-based approach to defense burn mitigation. When we started work with the Map Work Group on putting together this symposium, we felt like we needed a place to start in terms of the watershed approach. We didn't go so far as to define it explicitly, but you know, what are the general steps that you envision? And I believe a presentation that Joy Zedler gave at the last mitigation forum that we held out in Portland was the genesis of it, I think, these steps, as Bob Rumbaugh pointed out earlier. So right here on this flip chart here, we'll be keeping this up the entire time. The desired outcome you see at the top is black, the clarification of the logical steps of a watershed-based approach to compensatory mitigation. And the logical steps can be found in your course materials. There is embedded in that document called Purpose and Desired Outcomes, which we already discussed. And they're on pages 5 and 6 of your course materials. We have Ken Potter and Eric Stein who are going to speak next. And their presentations are going to be followed by a short question and answer session for you to ask some questions directly and then a facilitated discussion, a little bit different than what we've been doing so far. Not just Q&A, but a facilitated discussion to actually really try and hone in on what you think about these logical steps and what you would add or omit to change them. Ken Potter is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Wisconsin at Madison with research interests in hydrology and water resources. And Eric Stein is a principal scientist at the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. Head of the Watershed Department. Prior to joining the organization, Eric spent 6 years as a senior project manager with the Corps Regulatory Branch in the LA District and 4 years with the private consultant.
I'm just going to kick things off. I have to begin with a confession. I'm not really that much of a wetland expert. So I'm not the least expert person in this room. But I think I understand why I'm here now. It's because Joyce Edward began with these logical steps, and Joy couldn't make it here. And I'm a colleague, Joy. We worked together on a number of projects, and so probably some of that rubbed off on me. I do have some experience, though, with watersheds, having talked about them for 20 or so years, and I hope I can bring some of that to bear during this couple days. But this presentation, I'm going to rely heavily on Eric. I was fortunate in getting the assignment I did that Eric knew something about this subject. Eric's not my grad student, but I'm treating him like a grad student. I want to give Eric credit. I think he put together and I looked at it and said, I can't really imagine that. And I think he changed a couple slides based on some comments I made. I think that was just the information to me, actually. Another thing a grad student does is it tends to pay off. So Eric should get credit for the presentation. And
you should give him another PhD.
This slide that looks bad is probably my influence. So with that, I'll turn it over to Eric.
I'm wondering if my advisor will be happy or not that, you know, 10, 11 years out of grad school, I'm still thinking like a grad student. it's always an interesting assignment right after lunch to talk right after lunch and also to have the subject of your talk essentially be a straw man. So either everybody will be really surly or really sleepy, so I'm not really sure what's going to happen here, but we'll see. I think the theme for this session, what I'd like to interject is sort of to keep focusing on pragmatism, because I think Barbara and Rich gave us some really good kind of conceptual foundation to work from, but as a few folks have pointed out, really where the rubber hits the road is if you can make this work in a day-to-day operational aspect, as sort of Molly talked about a little bit earlier. So we'll try to keep a good dose of pragmatism going. I'm going to just skip through. I always put these, you know, where did we start? National Research Council recommendations talk a lot about watersheds and upland and wetland systems. And so we all know where we started from. This slide was up a little bit earlier about the 17-point action plan. And I'm focusing on this part, the integrating mitigation in a watershed context and sort of playing off. This is essentially what Rich's presentation in a way kind of boiled down to, which was identify the best opportunities, and determine in your for mitigation, and then decide how to put them together, how to stitch them together. So the question that I want to focus on is, what can we realistically accomplish? Okay, so really in this, you know, in the context where you don't have necessarily always the luxury of these watershed plans, what can you realistically accomplish in terms of getting people to think about doing mitigation in a watershed context? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the logical steps, which I'm assuming everybody has committed to memory. I know you've read your materials and committed those to memory. And then talk about some of the common elements. This is not working, so. Some of the common elements of watershed-based decision making, and then how you might apply those in the absence of a formal mitigation plan. Provide some examples of watershed-based decision making at multiple scales. Again, you know, the issue of scale. Talk about some barriers, which you know, there's a one of the papers that was in the preliminary reading. Thank you. Okay. Had some. You always have to think about, right, be pragmatic. What are your barriers to implementation and how you might overcome them? And then finish by giving just a few tools that we're using in California. I know there's going to be whole sessions on tools, so I'm not going to really spend more than a couple minutes on that. So really, from my perspective, what should we put forward as sort of our long-term goal? Is I think what we're really trying to do is come up with a paradigm shift. And I always like to kind of use HGM as I think, a really good example of this. If you look back at the 1995 National Mitigation National Action Plan for HGM, I would argue that only a small fraction of that action plan has ever really come to sort of fruition the way it was envisioned in the Federal Register. But what I would also argue is that one of the real successes and one of the tremendous contributions of HGM is it's really caused a paradigm shift. And the way we think about wetlands and wetland mitigation and the function-based language we use, I mean, that whole paradigm shift has come out of HGM and some of the work that Mark Brinson and Dan and others have done on that. So that's really the success. And even to the point, as you know, Ralph pointed out, when we do NWI mapping, we're doing this in California now, we're putting HGM modifiers on our NWI maps. So that's been a real success. And I think a goal here is really we're trying, even if some of the tools and some of the things we talk about sort of stumble and get misdirected and misused and morphed along the way, if we can accomplish a paradigm shift over time, and again, time is critical, is really important, because this doesn't happen overnight. These paradigm shifts take time. They take, you know, decades to really take root. And so if we're patient and sort of keep at it, hopefully this paradigm shift will occur and people will really sort of internalize the watershed context in mitigation decision making. So probably our decision is how can we sort of move that along and encourage and facilitate that. So this is our starting point. These are the five logical steps that were in the handout material. Landscape assessment, you know, where are we? Historic assessment, where did we come from? Assessment of remaining resources, what do we have left? Analysis of priorities and restoration options, where do we want to go? All right, some basic questions. In the literature review that ELI put together, which was a very nice synopsis of a lot of things that have been written on this topic, there were sort of five slightly different steps, but, you know, some similarities there. And, you know, this is not really anything new, per se. I mean, these are things that we've all seen before, okay? So this comes out of a publication that I think is really a real nice publication that came out in 1995 called The Ecosystem Analysis at the Watershed Scale. And so they came up with these five steps, and the Center for Watershed Protection has come up with these four steps. And so, you know, this is, it's like, okay, how many times are we going to kind of keep doing this over and over and over again, okay? So really what we're talking about is taking these and maybe now tunneling down and getting a little more depth and a little more meat on the bones here, because I think we have the bones. I mean, we've had the bones over and over. You know, really we're working at putting the meat on the bones now. So when I look at these four boxes and some other documents that have been written about approaches and watershed-based approaches, I think they kind of boil down to what I call these common elements. So this is sort of my distillation of what I've seen in all those different publications. They all start with some sort of goal and objective process. They all have some sort of inventory and assessment. There's usually historic, current, expected future. They all have some sort of determination of a desired future condition or a frame of reference, and they all have then some sort of priority setting. And one of the important things that a couple people have touched on is this loop is really iterative, and this has to be iterative because you really can't identify your goals until you've done this and this, and then when you get down here, it's modified by what you started from. So it's really this iterative process that has to continue to sort of be an evolving, ongoing process. Now, when I looked at these, and actually this came out of conversations that Ken and I had on the phone and were sort of talking about this, I start to think that there's probably a few things that are implicit in these steps that probably should be a little more explicit. And so I've added a few of those, and those are the things in red. And so I think these were always there, but they probably are worth explicitly adding. So one of the big ones that I would put here between sort of determining where you want to go and making some priorities and recommendations is this analysis of opportunities and constraints, because that's where the pragmatism comes in. Okay, what is realistic given the constraints of our landscape, whether it be altered draining and ditching and tiling or a dam upstream or a political landscape? There's always opportunities and constraints, and if you don't sort of explicitly feed those into the process, then you're kind of going down the primrose path, because you're going to have a plan that winds up on a shelf that is a nice academic exercise but really doesn't mean anything. And then this part down here, which I think is a challenge, because I think most of the plans that we all work on are driven a lot of times by grant monies and monies that have limited lifetimes. And one of the things is that you, without this sort of ongoing implementation plan, it can be an impediment, because people say it's people love to champion a cause, but really the sustainability is the challenge. And for that type of sustainability, it really relies on this ongoing monitoring and assessment and this feedback and plan refinement, and then a mechanism for financing the ongoing implementation and the data management. And so until we find sort of efficient mechanisms to build in this part, we're going to kind of, I think, continue to have these plans that only go so far. And then the last part here is that I bracketed all this with coordination with stakeholders and other programs, because I think, as John rightly pointed out, I have started in a federal agency, and when I was with the Corps, what was always sort of ingrained in us is that you are a regulatory agency, you're not a land use authority. Okay, the land use power for land use decision, it's a central concept of the United States, is that local jurisdictions have the authority for making land use decisions. And so that coordination and that integration is really critical to these types of programs. And similarly, there's lots of other watershed programs. They might be called different things, but there's lots of other watershed programs out there. There's stormwater management programs. Well, those are watershed programs. There's multi-species conservation programs. Well, those are watershed programs. There's water resource and water supply programs. Okay, those are all watershed programs. And so, again, the challenge is in this sort of information age to be able to harness all of the work and information that's being done by all these other watershed programs and kind of coordinate with them so that we can have some efficiencies with how we make these decisions and not be sort of operating across paths. So those are sort of kind of the, I think, implicit in these common elements, but I sort of spelled them out in a little more detail. Okay. So really, that's all kind of fine and good. That's a lot of concept and background. But the real question is, how do you apply these in the absence of a formal watershed plan? Because as Molly pointed out, there's probably only a small number of watersheds across the country that have these formal plans. So how do you apply that in the absence of that? So really what it comes down to, I think, is that the core, this is the same slide I put up before, but the core of this kind of framework is what I've highlighted, and this was yellow on my screen, so I guess it's a little bit warped here. But the center part is that, you're asking, what do you want? What do you want to do? What are your constraints? And then that determines your priorities. So that's kind of the nucleus of this type of approach. So page up here. What I did is I just took these steps, and I've just reprinted them without all the arrows. So the challenge should be to think about how to take these sort of common elements and identify what the analogs might be on a project-specific or a site-specific application. So what do these things translate to if you're not working within the context of a watershed plan? Okay. And so what I tried to do here is just, and these are, again, this is a straw man, but as to try to identify, you know, what some sort of project-specific analogs might be. So if you're doing inventory and assessment, you know, what are some of the questions you might be asking? If you're looking at reference, okay, there's some nice papers written on reference templates, okay, and what are those? What are your constraints? What are your priorities? So what is your mechanism for ongoing monitoring and management? How are you going to have an ongoing dialogue with stakeholders? And what other programs are already in place that you can integrate with? So again, this is sort of an attempt to try to almost ask a series of site-specific questions that will help implement these common elements. And these are, again, a straw man. Okay. So what I wanted to do next then is say, okay, so we've got these common elements. Let's look at a couple of examples. In talking to the folks from ELI on the phone, they said, well, give us some examples of how these things might have been done. You know, put some reality to it and show us some examples. So what I'm going to do is just spend a couple of minutes talking about some examples that I've come up with for how this type of paradigm or this thought process can be applied or has been applied. So again, the issue of scale, right, we keep coming back to scale. So you can do this at different scales. You can do this at a regional scale. You can do this at a sub-basin or a local catchment scale. You can do this at a project-specific scale, potentially. And again, it all depends on where you are and what resources you have and what other things are going on in your area. So for the regional scale, this is an example I shamelessly have stolen from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, Maryland DNR. This is from a presentation that David Burke, when he was with DNR, put together. So I'm using this from him. And in the case of Maryland, they've been fortunate because they actually have the infrastructure in place to be able to do something at this statewide scale where they've taken sort of, you know, this large region and they've started to identify some priorities for where they might put restoration on this sort of large regional scale. And then they can zero in at a specific watershed here. Okay, and then they can say, okay, well, what are, if we look at sort of the red colors, where are some of our restoration priorities for, you know, increasing stream corridors or other sorts of greenness, that would be right in here, this red that kind of goes along with this. So they can zoom in to that scale, and then they can go in even closer scale, this is that same area, and start to identify specific projects to say, okay, here's where we're going to do some fixing of channel incision and things like that. And so by doing these sort of site-specific projects, it will nest up and achieve our overall goals. So that's kind of one example of kind of the regional scale. And at the regional scale, you know, how you might take these common elements and apply them. Well, that's fine if you have that sort of large statewide or region-wide data to work off of. So this is an example of something that I'd worked on in Southern California. Probably looks familiar to you, Dan. San Juan Watershed, where, you know, there isn't kind of this statewide program, but it's more of a focused sort of watershed-specific element here. And this was to answer, this is, again, just one element of a larger program, but the goal here was to answer, okay, what do we know in terms of sediment transport in these watersheds? And so in this case, it was a very focused question about how to prioritize restoration in the watershed context, thinking about sediment transport. So using existing data, which is sort of the USGS geologic maps and the NRCS soil surveys and some DEMs from the USGS, so you have slope, you have geology, you have soils, what we did is essentially put together a map that identified in this watershed where are the areas that are sort of sediment sources of coarse sediment, okay, and those are the areas in sort of the blue and green hatching here, where are our key sediment transport reaches here, okay, to get down to this is the Pacific Ocean here, this is in South Orange County, and then where do you have in red some areas that are generating fine sediments, which are sort of a negative thing. So we're trying to think, okay, if we're trying to manage and restore this watershed, we want to know where the good sediment is coming from, how it's getting transported down the system ultimately to the coast, and where sort of the bad sediment, the fines that we'd really want to control, where are they coming from. So all this was done basically with existing data. There was really not a lot of new information gone out. It's just geology maps, soil maps, and some DEMs, and you can put this together and then ground truth it by going out to these areas. do is I'm going to focus in on this one small sub-basin here called Gabino Canyon. And you can go into this type of watershed and say, okay, well, now we know something about this watershed, so if I had to do some restoration planning in here, how might I focus that? So in this basin we divided it up into three, sort of an upper basin, a middle basin, and a lower basin. And in the upper basin, we have a lot of fine sediments, and we have problems with upland erosion. So that's kind of the issue for the upper basin. So in the upper basin, this is a picture of Upper Gabino. Our main goal would be to control erosion of fine sediments. So you could do some upland restoration, some revegetation. You have some incising channels here. And so your goal appears to restore your adjacent uplands to control erosion of fine sediments. In the middle part of the basin here, which is more geologically constrained, this is really a transport reach. So our goal here is to just protect that transport reach, buffer it a little bit, but there's not a lot of active restoration beyond protecting the transport function of that reach. Get down to the bottom here, we have more of a broad floodplain. This is a depositional area, and there's opportunities for floodplain restoration. So again, this is kind of an example of just a very small watershed using existing data that you can start to think about kind of watershed process and how you might have different restoration priorities in different locations in this watershed. And so what that generates then is a set of planning considerations for this specific area that says, okay, if you're going to do something in this particular watershed, Gabino Canyon watershed, you want to limit impervious surfaces in the upper basin, you want to restore headwater areas to reduce the production of fine sediment, you want to preserve the sediment transport reaches in the mid-basin. If you're going to have development, put it on the clay soils in the lower sub-basin where you get a proportionally smaller increase in runoff. Have some water quality in some of the degraded side canyons where you already have existing pits in the ground, and then there's opportunities for enhancement in the lower watershed. Again, this is not a big, huge, this is just kind of a very focused set of decision criteria for this specific area. Okay, so that's kind of the second scale. So I showed you Maryland has sort of the statewide regional scale. This is an example of kind of a one sub-basin scale. And then I tried to think, okay, well, what if you had to do this just on a sort of the checklist? This is sort of what Rich was talking a little bit about. If you said, okay, what if I had to incorporate this type of decision-making process using just kind of a checklist approach? Could you come up with some sort of yes-no questions that a project manager could sit at their desk and say, okay, I want to go, this is just to get my thought process going and what sort of questions I should be asking to think about, you know, making a mitigation decision in the watershed context. So, you know, does it contain originally rare wetlands? Okay, most project managers know that because they work in their area. You know, do other wetlands exist within 1 kilometer? And again, this is not, I didn't pull this number sort of, you know, totally arbitrary. There's been studies that have looked at scaling effects and how important the radius of adjacent land use is. Are there major coastal logistic constraints? You know, is the adjacent land use primarily opened? What's the upstream catchment hydrology look like? Are there other management programs in place? Is there a mechanism for monitoring? And are we expecting a lot of change in the future just looking at the local plans and general plans? So, again, the idea here is just a thought process to say if you don't have a watershed plan and you can't do it on a sub-basin basis, maybe there's a set of questions you can just start to internalize to kind of get your mind thinking on this watershed scale. Okay, so those are some sort of examples that were basically came out of discussions I had with Ken and with Rich and with other people on the phone, just kind of some brainstorming. So now the ever fun barriers. Always important to think about what are some of the barriers to sort of affecting this paradigm shift. So these are just some things. Again, nothing really new up here. This is stuff that, you know, a lot of people have written about, and I just tried to summarize. There's always, you know, do you have regionally or synoptic information at multiple scales that you can use to answer these questions? Is there a mechanism to easily compile and access this data? I think this is probably getting better as sort of GIS and internet technologies improve. We were talking at lunch about, you know, a lot of things that were written in the mid-90s were finally getting the technology to the point where it can actually do some of the things that people have been writing about for 10 years. This one, in my mind, is kind of, these next two are some of the real biggies here, is differences in institutional agency missions or objectives. Okay, everybody's experienced this. You go to three agencies, you get five answers in terms of what their goals and priorities are and what they want to prioritize. Okay, and so this culture of sort of institutional differences is something that's really difficult to overcome. Even in our water boards in California, we have nine regional boards that manage water quality in the state of California. And I've sat in meetings where you have the head of their TMDL unit and the head of their stormwater unit totally going across paths. And, you know, the way this program is supposed to work is you write a TMDL and it's implemented through the stormwater program, okay? And so even within an agency, you have that problem. So when you start to go between agencies, you sort of multiply that problem. So that's just an issue or a barrier that we need to be aware of. This efficient mechanism for including land use authorities, local land use authorities, some agencies are better at than others, sort of the reaching out and really sort of internalizing that local land use authorities are partners in this process, and that, you know, the command and control regulatory structure has to be able to sort of interface with the local land use authority. And as I think John put it really well, without that, it's just kind of, we're just kind of spinning our wheels. And so, again, some agencies are really good at doing this, some agencies not so good. And then mechanisms to integrate or balance other watershed management programs. Okay, we see this a lot where I work, where you have multi-species conservation programs to manage some upland species has one goal, and your water quality program has another goal, and your flood control agency has another goal, and your vector control agency has another goal. And they're all sort of collecting the same information, and they all have the same maps, but they're kind of sometimes working across purposes. So there's probably a lot of opportunity for some better coordination there. So I have sort of a rule that we always operate on is, you know, don't throw stones unless you have potential solutions. So don't criticize unless you have sort of a potential alternative to propose. So I always like to, my next slide is just some recommendations that we might use to overcome those barriers. And, you know, part of that has to do with clearly articulating your objectives and communicating those to other folks working in your area. Choosing, we had a couple people talked about the appropriate management unit and making sure that sort of the management unit is sort of commensurate with the questions you're trying to answer. These next two sort of go together, that, you know, this is a big deal, this is a big issue. Watersheds are a sort of big, complex things, and so it's really important to kind of take this phasing approach and little steps, baby steps, one bite at a time, and kind of in an iterative manner build up to sort of the larger answers, but kind of to do it in an iterative basis. This is important because, you know, as scientists, what's the last part of any scientific paper you read is, we need more data, right? It's always the last part of any scientific paper. So the trick is really to understand the implications of those data gaps and then prioritize what's the most important new data to gather. So to go through, that's again that iterative process. To integrate into existing programs, I think this, again, is getting better with people starting to talk a little bit more and say, okay, there's some give and take here. And then this one here, I think the long-term data management and access is, again, this, I think people are recognizing it more, and with web-based tools, it's a little better, but the ability to share data that individual groups collect and make that accessible so everybody can take advantage of that. So I think that was my last slide. Oh, I forgot about that. I was going to give you a few examples of tools. So in my last 2 minutes, I'll just blow through some tools to give you some examples of things we're doing in California to try and kind of implement some of this watershed-based approach. And I'll start by saying our tools that we're using in California are really based on EPA's. This is EPA's sort of level 1, 2, 3 paradigm for integrated monitoring and assessment, which is, says that you need to answer some questions about inventory, where your resources are. You need to answer some questions about the kind of regional condition of your resources. And then you need to answer some site-specific process-based questions. And all of these things feed into each other, and you need all three of them to have sort of an integrated program. So that's kind of EPA's paradigm, and we subscribe to that. And I'm not going to talk too much about level one. We are doing some stuff with some remote sensing and mapping. We're working with NWI. I'm not going to really talk too much about that. I wanted to talk mainly about level two because I think in the context of watershed-based decision-making, level two is kind of where it's at. That's where the rubber hits the road, is if you have good tools to do these level two assessments. So the two examples I'm going to give you are, this is a project we're doing in cooperation with NOAA. Elisa is a big person responsible for this, where we're essentially taking a series of data layers, land cover, some topography, series of sort of spatial data layers, and they're integrated into a program we call the Southern California Riparian Ecosystem Assessment Method, SCREAM. Right, everybody needs a good acronym, nice and catchy that you can remember. And the idea is that these data layers essentially all feed into a GIS-based system, and there's a series of kind of rule-based models in here that says, you know, if your channel condition is like this, and you have certain adjacent land use of this characteristic, it then basically spits out for different areas in different sort of stream reaches, and that gives you overall conditions. So the idea is it takes GIS data through an automated decision, some a series of decision rules, and allows you to sort of rank the quality of your stream reaches and get an overall condition score. And then the last example is, as was Rich talked about, our California Rapid Assessment Method, again, which is a site-based method, and this is to look at some different attributes of wetland condition, as well as the stressors on those attributes, and come up with an overall condition score. And so again, we see that this site-based method can be used in an ambient monitoring perspective, like the map that Rich showed, which was some work that Josh did, where you go out and do this CRAM, this California Rapid Assessment, on a bunch of sites, and that feeds into giving you your watershed perspective. And so together, something like SCREAM and CRAM together work together to give you that regional picture. So those are just some quick examples of tools, and I'm not going to go into much more detail about that. But together, all three of these things give you sort of an integrated watershed-based monitoring and assessment program. And so this is kind of the paradigm we work in California. So with that, I'll just conclude encouraging the paradigm shift. I started by saying that what we ought to be doing is encouraging or facilitating this paradigm shift. And so the way to do that is we have some work to do on developing tools to facilitate that watershed perspective. We have to address some of the barriers of implementation. Efficient mechanisms for information exchange and interagency jurisdiction communication, and some tools for ongoing monitoring and assessment at the multiple scales. And so those are kind of some of the potential focal areas to encourage this paradigm shift. So with that, I think I made it in my time with like one right on. So
thank you.